loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big issues. The New York Times is reporting that President Trump enlisted his attorney to demand that Attorney General Jeff Sessions not recuse himself from the Russia investigation. Is this obstruction of justice or a meaningless detail seized upon by the media? Then Pakistan Today expressed, quote, deep disappointment after President Trump announced a cutoff in security aid to the country. What does this change in policy mean for counterterrorism operations and for the broader picture of U.S.-Pakistan relations? But first, we turn to the report in the New York Times that President Trump enlisted his attorney to demand that Attorney General Jeff Sessions not recuse himself from the Russia investigation. Is this obstruction of justice or a meaningless detail seized upon by the media? We are joined from Minnesota by Colleen Raleigh. She is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year along with two other whistleblowers. And we're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He is a human rights and labor lawyer, and he is the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. Welcome, Colleen and Dan.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Dan Kovalik, let's start with you real quickly. Donald Trump has been saying out loud and in public that he was very angry and was even thinking about firing Jeff Sessions for recusing himself from the Russia investigation. That's not like a news flash. And yet the New York Times article about the fact that his attorney went and talked to Sessions and tried to convince Sessions not to recuse himself, it has a kind of breathlessness about it as if it's a smoking gun of some type. What's your take?
Yeah, my take is that, you know, this whole Russia collusion alleged scandal is falling apart. And so the media, including the New York Times, are doing everything they can to revive it or keep it on, keep it alive. And I think this is an example. As you say, it was earlier in 2017 that Trump was very open that he didn't think Sessions should recuse himself. Again, everyone reported on that. So what's the difference if his lawyer went to Sessions and told him he shouldn't recuse himself? It seems to me it's worse that Trump did it himself, but that's old news now.
Yeah, that's actually the question that I have. Let's turn to Colleen. Colleen, I'm not an attorney. Both of you are. This smacks of obstruction of justice to me, unnecessarily so. Is that what we're looking at here?
Well, this particular set of facts and circumstances involved in Russiagate is beyond bizarre. It's, we just keep falling into the rabbit's hole further and further. So a situation where a president tells his attorney general not to recuse himself, I think, is unprecedented, as is the situation of having both presidential campaigns under investigation by the FBI, both before and now after the election. And here we are around the world spreading democracy and saying the reason we have to bomb and destroy countries is to spread American values. And we have a situation now where both presidential campaigns were under investigation before and now after the investigation. So this is beyond, you can't really go by the old precedents. In my case, if you look back, back before I retired in 2004, most obstruction of justice matters that I was aware of involved real concrete cases like destroying evidence, tampering with a witness or jury, like when John Gotti would try to get off for the umpteenth time and go after a juror or something like that. Those were the kinds of cases that people thought of as obstruction of justice. This kind of a thing where you're having a president contact an attorney or indirectly tell his attorney general not to recuse himself, I think is pretty far-fetched compared to what I was aware of. But there's one more thing I should just mention is the entrapment has really become in vogue. It's become very popular. So there's also this notion that you can provoke a person to basically commit obstruction of justice. There would be an issue of whether there is, you have to have a real crime. In order to obstruct justice, doesn't there have to be a, you have to prove that there is a real crime. If someone just overreacts, and of course, to be honest, with Trump, it probably is quite easy to get him to overreact. We see it daily. Can that actually now constitute obstruction of justice?
Yeah, Dan Kovalik, I think Colleen is so right. It's completely bizarre what's going on. You have the Mueller investigation. You have the Senate Judiciary Committee investigation. You have the House Intelligence Committee investigation. You now have the reopening by the FBI of the investigation of the Clinton Foundation. I think we should talk about that a little bit. And now there's also a criminal referral, John, from the Senate Intelligence Committee to the DOJ regarding Christopher Steele. That's new news today.
Yeah, that's new news today. So the Senate Judiciary Committee, led by Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican of Iowa, sent a letter that was co-signed by Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, to the Deputy Attorney General and the Director of the FBI. It's a criminal referral asking that Christopher Steele, former British MI6 officer, be investigated with an eye toward charging him with a violation of the federal code that equates to making a false statement to a federal law enforcement officer. And what they're saying is that Christopher Steele, at some point during a conversation with an FBI agent, said something related to the dossier that was not true. This is probably a political stunt. It's probably meant to put pressure on Robert Mueller. But like everything else in this odyssey, this saga, we have to just wait to see how it plays out.
Go ahead, Dan.
Well, I mean, Brian, I think the first thing you kind of touched upon was that it appears now that our government's main function is to, for the different branches to investigate each other. They don't do much else. They don't pass much legislation. It is kind of bizarre. And it has become kind of a snake eating its own tail. But the question does come back to, where is the there in terms of Russia collusion? Again, there doesn't seem to be anything significant that's come out in terms of an indictment or referral on that issue. And I think people have to take a step back and ask, you know, what has all this been about? You know, this investigation is now been going on for many months now, and it will go on for many more months. And what has been found out? I mean, again, most people are now going to be charged with anything for just lying to a federal investigator, which I guess they shouldn't do. But again, as was touched upon, if there was no crime to begin with, what is all this about?
Okay, so again, the Republican chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee recommended Friday that the Justice Department investigate for possible criminal charges the author of the now famous dossier alleging that the Trump campaign coordinated with the Kremlin during the 2016 election. And here's what the Washington Post says about it. The move by Senator Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, marks a major escalation in conservatives' challenge to the FBI's credibility as the agency investigates whether any Trump associates committed crimes. Another Republican, as we mentioned, Lindsey Graham, joined in the letter to the Justice Department. So, again, this gets very complicated, I think, for people who are not paying careful attention. And I think most people's eyes start to glaze over at a certain point. But Christopher Steele was hired by Fusion GPS, which was paid for by the Republican rival of Donald Trump during the primary campaign. Maybe that was Ted Cruz. Maybe that was the Mercer families who had in their staple Steve Bannon. After, of course, Trump won the primary and was going to be the Republican nomination, the Republicans didn't want to have a dirt report, the Steele dossier against Trump, because now Trump was their candidate. So the Democrats purchased the dossier, and the Democratic National Committee and Clinton did. And then later, Colleen, if I'm not mistaken, James Comey offered to pay for the dossier until it became public knowledge, and then the FBI sort of backed away from the author. And now we have the author of the dossier being referred for criminal, possible criminal charges to the DOJ by the Republican Party. Wow. I mean, it does make one's eyes sort of glaze over. Go ahead.
Yeah, it definitely does. It's hard to follow it so bad. And I think that the wheeling and the bottom line is the wheeling and dealing, the Manafort type revolving door wheeling and dealing amongst political officials, retired generals, really the whole establishment in Washington, D.C., has become so normalized. I'm not a fan of Trump, but you can kind of sympathize just to a small extent with his looking out there and saying, well, look, everybody is doing this. Why are you going after me when everyone else is doing this? And certainly the facts you just went through basically illustrate how rampant it is. GPS Fusion was not only working as opposition research for the Clinton campaign, but they were the ones who helped set up, they were the ones working with the Russian attorney that was lobbying against the Magnitsky Act. They were working with her at the same time as they were working Christopher Steele and the Clinton campaign. I mean, on the foreign influence operations and spying, which now again has become, and I would just go back and say there's a country that kind of led the way here, which was not Russia, but there was a country that really led the way in influence operations and spying on the United States. And it has really been a cancer that has spread. And now it's very difficult, like you say, your eyes just glaze over at how convoluted it's become.
Yeah, John, here's a situation where the Clinton Foundation and the DNC, well, not the Clinton Foundation, let's put the Clinton Foundation to the side, because that investigation that's now reopened by the FBI,
yes,
under the leadership of the Republican Party now, Jeff Sessions is the Attorney General, and the FBI is part of the Department of Justice. They're reopening the investigation against Clinton, and the Republicans and Trump have been saying for a long time, why did that investigation stop? In other words, there might be a pay to play. And that certainly seemed that way in terms of who gave donations to the Clinton Foundation, these tens of millions, more than $100 million, I think, in donations. And you can see by some of the email releases that people were making donations to this private foundation while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State,
right,
with the idea that they were going to have a meeting in Washington with the Secretary of State, then Hillary Clinton. And there's lots of other...
And there's pretty clear evidence that that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. And then the other thing that Colleen is mentioning, which I think is extremely important and, again, gets lost under the sort of, it's below the radar a little bit, is if the DNC hired Christopher Steele, a foreign intelligence agent, of course, British, so not an evil Russian intelligence agent, but a foreign intelligence agent to dig up dirt on Donald Trump. And there was all that salacious detail. Well, where did he get his information? That came from Russian sources, because who would know about what Donald Trump did in Russia over the years, except Russians?
Yeah,
so you could make the same argument that both sides, or certainly the Clinton campaign, was colluding with, quote, the Russians, because that's a generic term now. It doesn't matter whether it's Putin or
that's right.
a Russian company or a Russian lawyer. It just doesn't matter. If you're Russian, you're part of the Russians. I mean, when you look through the whole thing, you can make the argument, at least rhetorically, that everyone was colluding and that everyone was engaged in some level of criminality in this thing. Or maybe it's not criminal because it's America, but anywhere else it might be criminal.
You know, and this comes down to something that John Dean said yesterday. John Dean, the famed Watergate era whistleblower, he said that if Fox News had existed in 1974, Richard Nixon would never have been forced out of office. And that's true, because what we're seeing now is members of Congress, the FBI, the special counsel's office, the White House, the Democrats, both parties on Capitol Hill, all throwing mud at each other, all raising these different scandals with the hope that they can distract enough people for a long enough period of time that the scandals that affect them go away. But that's not democracy. That's a perversion of democracy.
That's a weapon of mass distraction, because
indeed
it really is a mass distraction. And you know, Dan, I know a lot of progressive activists, my friends, my colleagues, people were out at the airport when protesting against the Muslim travel ban, and that's what it really was, even if he tried to dress it up as something else. People were in the streets protesting against misogyny, against the targeting of immigrant communities and breaking up immigrant families. And then a big part of that liberal opposition to Trump, or progressive opposition, became spectators watching and hoping that the Democrats, using the very, I would say, nefarious means to undo Trump, and both sides using the idea that the other side is criminal, people just became passive and paralyzed instead of being in the streets where it really might make a difference.
Well, right. Well, and what has the result been? I mean, those who have hoped that the Russiagate scandal would bring down Trump, what they should be seeing is that the Russiagate scandal has probably encouraged Trump to prove that he's not a pawn of Russia by now providing lethal force to the right-wing government in Kiev, Ukraine, which could lead to the deaths of thousands of people in that country. And so those who have been cheerleading the Russiagate scandal really have to take some responsibility for probably, for a possible war developing in Ukraine. And meanwhile, there's no coverage being given to the Ukraine, nor, of course, to the U.S.'s continued collusion, if you will, with Saudi Arabia in destroying the country of Yemen. Those are the things people should really be caring about right now. Instead, they have this sideshow.
Yeah, Colleen, I was looking at an article in The Intercept the other day by James Risen, the New York Times reporter, who made a very interesting point. It's a story I think everyone should read about what actually happened to him at the New York Times, mm-hmm. and how the government, the Obama administration, and now, I've got, of course, others, were going after reporters and their sources and trying to criminalize leakers, which was not the case in the past. And one of the points that Risen makes is that the Valerie Plame story became a turning point where the liberals and opponents of Bush who used the prosecution of Judith Miller and the war launched by Patrick Fitzgerald against reporters, the special prosecutor, they were sort of cheering all of that on because Fitzpatrick became sort of a proxy or a stand-in for their opposition to Bush administration's very egregious policies in Iraq. But what it really did is it constituted a pivotal turning point where it then opened the door to the targeting of whistleblowers at a much more dynamic pace and the targeting of reporters and their sources. So the Democrats, those who would have presumably, and the liberals who would have been presumably champions of press freedom and not wanting to go after reporters, suddenly sort of put that issue, the issue of free speech and free press, to the side in pursuit of a political agenda because of their opposition to Bush's other policies. It seems to me that that is strikingly similar to what we have going on right now in the way the struggle against Trump is manifesting. What do you think?
Absolutely. Totally agree. This partisanship is really a sickening thing, because it makes people forget about issues. They bond with their team. And of course, there's, if you talk about whistleblower and telling the truth, the first victim of these groupthink is basically the truth. And I think you're Ryzen is exactly right about that, and you are right about it. I think Dan is right also about the fact that the distraction from really big issues like what's going on in Ukraine right now is really problematic. Another real downside, bad consequence of this Russiagate, McCarthyism, is the need for these factions now who are fighting with each other, the partisan factions, to control the media. And so you see all of this fake news, entities springing up, protecting democracy think tanks in Europe, and they're all trying to censor. I've heard that Macron, the leader of France, is trying to have a law that will ban or prohibit, quote unquote, fake news. I mean, this actually goes way beyond even what Obama was doing, going after leakers and whistleblowers. If you can imagine a situation where trying to control the message in the media, and this is absolutely emanating from this this struggle for power, I don't know what you want to call it, but this infighting that's going on between different factions, which, by the way, on a lot of issues actually are in very solid agreement with each other. They don't necessarily disagree about corruption in government. They really are kind of for that. It's just that they disagree on being in who's in power, and they are tearing this down. And I think that the First Amendment is the victim. The truth and the First Amendment is the victim of this Russiagate hysteria.
Brian, one of the things that amazed me from this New York Times piece, and I agree with you, it was sort of breathlessly nonsensical, but one of the things that was fascinating was when Dan McGahn, the attorney whom President Trump dispatched to lobby Jeff Sessions, returned to the White House and said that Sessions wasn't going to play ball, that he was going to recuse himself. Several different senior White House officials confirmed that the president shouted, "Where's my Roy Cohn?" Roy Cohn having been the red baiting counsel to Senator Joe McCarthy and Trump's personal attorney until he was disbarred for unethical behavior in 1986 in New York State. The New York Times goes on to say that if anything shows consciousness of guilt, it's that statement.
You know, the other thing before we go back to Dan, there's another piece of this, which is something logical, is right now the Democratic opposition and CNN to Trump. And again, we're not friends of Trump. We're opponents of, I am a serious opponent of Donald Trump. But the Democratic opposition and the media opposition are making the argument that Trump wanted to get rid of Sessions because wanted to have Sessions recuse him, did not want Sessions to recuse himself in order to protect Trump. But obviously, Jeff Sessions didn't listen to Donald Trump, which means that Jeff Sessions had a capacity for independence from Donald Trump. But right now, the argument is being made that the prosecution isn't going ahead vigorously enough by the FBI and the DOJ because Jeff Sessions is just screening or shielding Donald Trump. So in a way, you can't have it both ways, can you? Go ahead, Dan.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that's a good point, that Sessions does not appear to be a mere foot soldier for Trump and that he could act independently, though I do think in the case of him recusing himself from the Russiagate investigation, was, you know, largely motivated so that he could try to save his own skin, obviously.
Yeah, and he's a despicable figure anyway, just so there's no confusion. I mean, the guy's awful.
Yes, and unprincipled. But one thing I just wanted to add, if I could, you know, we were just talking about the kind of evil manifestations of this partisanship in this country. You know, it just the statistics for last year came out that Trump deported less Mexican immigrants in 2017 than Obama had, I believe, in his first year of office. You know, Obama became the deporter-in-chief, deported 2.5 million people, and I don't remember any airport protests at that point. The point being that while Trump is bad and we oppose him, of course, rightfully, the vilification of him is going to lead to something inevitable, and that is that people will be relieved to get any president other than Trump. And that really isn't the point, right? We need to fight for bigger issues than that. But at this point, most Americans who are pushing to get rid of Trump will be now happy with Mike Pence, who probably would be worse. And I guess the point is, when you stop caring about principles and about issues and only root for your team, nothing good comes of that.
Especially when your team isn't really your team. I mean, this is kind of a false patriotism because, you know, you and Colleen are completely right. The Democrats and the Republicans are equally awful when it comes to the military-industrial complex, when it comes to war, when it comes to occupation, when it comes to the surveillance state. And why should the people of the United States simply line up behind either one of them and say, that's my team and I'm going to root for them no matter what, right? I mean, go ahead, Colleen.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. People, it's really disappointing and dismaying to see so many people basically lose their ability to critically think and even people that, like you say, a couple of years ago, they seemed to care about an issue. And all of a sudden, a year later, when their team leader changes, they completely don't even care about that anymore. And you know, we could do something. If we really have a democracy, it requires people. It can't be this group of elites fighting with each other that are wealthy and, you know, basically involved with the military industrial complex. That's not going to get us anywhere. The only hope we have is for people, average people, to understand the issues and then to take some action so that we can, you know, transcend some of these really important we've got really, really serious issues confronting us right now. And yet the people are caught up, completely distracted. So I couldn't agree more with the problem here. And the question is how to, and I think the First Amendment, freedom of speech, and getting the media to finally get on board and start explaining some of these issues instead of being involved in the charade. Right now, they're just happy to be involved in the charade. They've got to figure out what's important and basically start getting back to telling people the truth about things. You know, talk about Ukraine, talk about climate change, talk about some of these important issues instead of this Russiagate, which is just distracting everyone from the real problems.
Brian, we have about 30 seconds left. I just wanted to leave our guests with one final thought. The last president that we had who was not a professional politician, someone who had risen through the ranks of elected political office, was Herbert Hoover. And, you know, I wonder if maybe we're just looking too much into this. Maybe Donald Trump is just an idiot. Maybe there's no real criminal intent as much as there is the fact that the guy's just an idiot and he's gotten himself into this. We're going to leave it there. We were joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. Colleen is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we were joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. Dan's a human rights attorney and labor lawyer who is also the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. Thank you both for joining us. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Loud and Clear, and we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Pakistan today expressed, quote, deep disappointment, close quote, after President Trump announced a cutoff in security aid to the country. What does this change in policy mean for counterterrorism operations and for the larger U.S.-Pakistan relationship? We're joined from Washington by Marvin Weinbaum. He is the scholar in residence for the Middle East Institute Center for Pakistan Studies. Welcome back, Marvin.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. This is huge. I mean, this represents, I would say, a sea change in U.S.-Pakistani relations. What's your take?
Well, it's been heading in this direction for quite a long time. I think that when the new administration came in, there was a sense here that maybe because they didn't get along all that well with the Obama people, that there was going to be a reset in relations. They figured that they never got a very good hearing on their side of the issue, which is essentially we're doing everything we can, so don't nag us. They thought that with the Trump administration that they would get this hearing and that relations would improve. But I think this was misguided thinking because the new administration, we knew from the outside, was going to focus heavily on Afghanistan and be listening primarily to the generals. And the generals are frustrated because of the belief, not entirely unfounded, that Pakistan's failure to be more helpful is at least in part responsible for the failures of military strategy in Afghanistan. So this has been long in coming, and I think that it was made very clear last August when the president made remarks in the course of outlining his policy, his new strategy on Afghanistan, in which he indicated that he had a very short fuse when it came to listening to Pakistan anymore, and that I think there was every hint here of what we now see, which is the cutoff of all security support, which could total here, if some of it is not restored, $1.3 billion.
Marvin, $1.3 billion sounds like a lot of money, but some commentators today are saying that it actually isn't. With the closeness of Pakistan's relations with both China and Saudi Arabia, could they make up that $1.3 billion?
Yes, I think those commentators are correct that although that is not unimportant for a country whose economic circumstances are not particularly in fine shape, nevertheless, the way in which they would look at that is, that 1.3, we don't get to see much of it anyway. Some, of course, the military side, they do get on earmarked funds. But generally speaking, they say, you sell us arms, but your companies make the profits here. It's a sense here that this is not necessarily going to be the hit that you think it's going to be on us. So, yes, they. I don't believe if they think, rightly or wrongly, that their policy is in the national interest, that they're going to be bought off, if you will, by any amount of money that the U.S. is likely to be able to withhold.
John Kiriakou, those are important points because U.S. military aid to countries like Pakistan or countries like Egypt, while they sound like big numbers, as you pointed out, that money can be replaced or isn't that vital to the maintenance of the security apparatus anyway. It's symbolic. It's also a message. We're going to maintain the relationship. There are challenges. There are tensions. But, ultimately, we're still, quote, on the same team. That's really what those aid packages mean.
I think so. Frankly, I think that the United States stands to lose more from this action than the Pakistanis do. We've got a certain number of military personnel in the country. I probably shouldn't be more specific than that. The United States conducts cross-border raids, whether it's with or without the permission or acquiescence of the Pakistani government. But we stand to lose more from Pakistani non-cooperation due to this aid cutoff than the Pakistanis stand to lose.
You're making a very important point here because whatever our differences are with the Pakistan military, we do have intelligence sharing arrangements. They are, as you suggest here, rather critical, both for our keeping an eye on potential terrorists. I should also mention also our keeping an eye on the disposition of Pakistan's nuclear arsenal, concern here about that perhaps at some future time falling into the wrong hands. So we have a necessity here to engage with Pakistan. And of course, the most obvious one is that in order to keep furnishing our forces in Afghanistan, we need access to Afghanistan, and the only reasonable access that there is here, both on the air, in the air and on the ground, is through Pakistan. So the stakes are pretty high here for a return, which it's uncertain here the extent to which Pakistan really would be able to turn around or help us turn around the conflict in Afghanistan.
Well, let's explore that, because maybe that's going to be the big story. Does this impact the U.S. war in Afghanistan, which just goes on and on and on? And of course, as a consequence of the geography, the United States needs access somewhere. I want to talk to you, John Kiriakou, because you also have great knowledge about this personally. What the U.S. might lose as a consequence of the deterioration. Again, Pakistan is not going to go broke. Pakistan is going to not become like a minor country suddenly. But here's what the Pakistan Foreign Minister, Asif, said in his tweets in response, because this may be the more important part of the story. He condemned the U.S. and the cost of the war on terror fought in Afghanistan since 2001. Quote, "Our country witnessed the worst bloodbath. You carried out 57,800 attacks on Afghanistan from our bases. Your forces were supplied arms and explosives through our soil. Thousands of our civilians and soldiers became victims of the war initiated by you. We considered your enemy as our own. We filled the Guantanamo Bay. For the past 4 years, we have been clearing the debris. We are feeling sorry as you are not happy, but we will not compromise on our prestige anymore." That's the Pakistan foreign minister.
You can't get much more clear than that. And the foreign minister has a very important point here. If you ask any Pakistani, whether at the topmost levels of government or the man walking in the street in Lahore, he'll tell you exactly the same thing, that they've bent over backwards to help the United States. When I was stationed in Pakistan, there was literally nothing that the Pakistanis would not do for us. You know, when we were raiding terrorist safe houses, they were the first ones through the door. We would ask them to arrest their own citizens without benefit of trial and send them to Guantanamo. And they did it without even asking a question.
Yeah, well, let me interject something. I think everything you said, I agree with, but also recognize that there are elements in Pakistan that were not helpful.
Oh, yes. Oh, listen, at ISI, you get the stink eye from people with really long beards.
Who's ISI? Help the audience.
I'm sorry. ISI is the Pakistani Intelligence Service. These were the guys that helped to create the Taliban. These were the guys that helped to arm and to train the Kashmiri separatists. Yeah, you're exactly right about that.
Yeah, I mean, what the problem has been that they've had two foreign policies. One of them is one which is cooperative with us and recognizes that a stable, united, peaceful Afghanistan would be in their interest. And the other is that they really have held in reserve all this time these forces, which they think they're going to need, friendly Pashtuns, in the event that Afghanistan breaks up. So they've held them in reserve. That proxy force has been there, and that's the unhelpful part of it. But there is the other side, and the trouble is that those two elements in their foreign policy are in contradiction.
Indeed. And let me ask you too, Marvin, what role does India play in all this? Or what role does U.S. policy toward India play in this?
Well, first of all, India is the big piece here as far as Pakistan is concerned. Pakistan sees India using Afghanistan as a proxy. It fears that India will have a presence in Afghanistan, which will ultimately be threatening to Pakistan. Now, whether this is realistic or not, beside the point, there is a good deal of paranoia in this. But nevertheless, this is what drives their security policy, what India is up to. And as far as India is concerned, India wants to see a survival of an Afghanistan government which is not in the hands of a radical Islamic force, because it sees that as just the beginning of what could be a radicalization of the entire subcontinent. It sees that if the Taliban were restored, and because they're not the same Taliban that they were in the 90s, that there will be a blowback on Pakistan, which now has an Islamic insurgency of its own, and that ultimately this will have impact on India itself, because these elements are as anti-Indian as any in Pakistan. So, and they worried about the fact that they've got a very large Muslim population themselves.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in Washington in our studio by John Kiriakou. You can hear our show every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. We're speaking with Marvin Weinbaum about the cutoff of U.S. aid and security relationship with Pakistan, a decision taken today by the Trump administration. Mr. Weinbaum is a scholar in residence for the Middle East Institute Center for Pakistan Studies. Marvin, we're trying to speculate here earlier today about why Trump did this now. And you said this was a long time in coming. And obviously, it's not just Trump. Obama administration had plenty of complaints against Pakistan. But one of the issues that we were wondering about, or some of the people on our staff were wondering about, is does the Indian BJP party, the ruling party, the Conservative Hindu Nationalist Party, does it have additional influence inside the Trump administration? And could that be a factor in Trump's calculations? What's your take on that?
Well, that's not entirely wrong. It's a conservative religious government, increasingly so. Certainly, we feel the Trump administration probably feels more comfortable with India, although the Obama administration certainly had tilted towards India. I don't think that is as important a factor. I think it's important as far as the fears that Pakistan has here, that this government will be more aggressive. But I don't believe it's a factor here driving what we're witnessing now in terms of American policy. Again, I think that this is simply the frustration here of this administration listening to the military, who understandably is saying, since they believe that Pakistan can help them turn around, seriously help them turn around this insurgency, that unless we pressure Pakistan sufficiently, we're not going to get the support we need, and that, and they, rightly or wrongly, that without that support, we cannot have victory. Now, for them, victory does not mean defeating the Taliban. It means ultimately driving the Taliban to the peace table. One further thought here, and that is the problem now is that it's gotten much more complicated. There's not just the Taliban that is an element of the insurgency, but you've got out there, in addition to Al-Qaeda, you've got Islamic State, you've got something called IMU, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, and various elements here that are determined to fight to the end in Afghanistan. They have no interest whatsoever in a political settlement.
Marvin, the Pakistanis have long historic ties to the Saudi government and are also close to the Qataris. Do you think there's any chance that the Saudis or the Qataris can bring these different sides to the table and to try to work something out?
No, not really. I don't think that they're equipped diplomatically really for this. And anyway, Saudi Arabia comes into the picture here because Saudi Arabia is very much a factor as well in pushing the thinking here within Pakistan. And of course, Saudi Arabia does so because it's got Iran in mind. So I don't see that as a. I would think if you were looking for a country that somehow would have some standing here as in a mediating position, you'd look to Turkey because it has increasingly Islamic government, and it also I think would has a great deal to lose by instability in this region. And for I believe all of the countries ultimately in the region would be the losers here. Where there is great instability and chaos in Afghanistan really is not in anyone's interest, including the Pakistanis.
I wanted to ask you something that's not been in the papers, but it's something that has been sort of weighing on me. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee issued a report in 2011 saying that Afghanistan was responsible for the cultivation of something like 93% of the world's heroin poppy. In the American Embassy in Islamabad, there's quite a large DEA contingent, and the relationship between DEA and the Pakistani government has always been very close. Do you see that changing with this cutoff in military assistance? And if so, what's that going to do to the proliferation of heroin in the region?
Well, that is all very well established right now. I don't think we have any. We succeeded with our involvement in Pakistan in getting heroin or poppy production out of Pakistan. But really, that's on the back burner now. We've determined that whatever we might do in attempting, and it's being done to a minor extent, in cutting off the production could be counterproductive at this point as we try to gain a foothold, really, in areas of the country like Helmand and Kandahar provinces, where this is the livelihood of so many people. So I don't think we're going to see that as a major factor here. But you point out something else. It's outfits like the DEA that are, I'm really speculating on this, are in certain jeopardy here because our ability to put groups like that in Pakistan who are monitoring developments and ultimately, of course, supporting American interests, those are likely to be, it would seem to me, to be on a very short stay if this continues.
Let's talk about some of these other implications. And of course, we are speculating. This is all new breaking news. U.S. governments, not just Trump, earlier governments, including Obama, very frustrated with Pakistan's dual role, dual and contradictory role, say, in Afghanistan and in the region. But we don't know the fallout. And I want to get back to Marvin and ask him what the goal is of the Trump administration. Is it to sort of just a lashing out at Pakistan out of frustration, or is there an attempt or a feeling, I mean, that in the Trump administration that by taking punitive actions against Pakistan, that there will be a substantial change in Pakistan's conduct on some of these issues? I want to ask you that. But before I do, Marvin, just for our audience, which may not be that familiar with the area, Pakistan has a coast on the Indian Ocean, but it shares a border with Iran, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, China, India. So in other words, what happens in Pakistan regionally has a profound impact, not just inside the country, but on the region. So anyway, go ahead about what you think the goal is of the Trump administration's actions.
Well, it's not been specifically spelled out, but what they want here is the clear break between the security forces, the Pakistan security forces, and the Taliban and the Haqqani network, who those two really are one now. At one time, they operated much more independently. They don't any longer. What we're looking for is that, because we believe that these are the two groups over which Pakistan has some influence, and has been working through, whereas because most of the other groups are actually anti-Pakistani. So we want to see them evicted from the country. We want clear evidence here. Now, the Pakistanis come back and say, well, we did dislodge them. They were in northern Waziristan, but our camp military campaign, which began in 2014, has largely flushed them out. They are now gone into Afghanistan. We can't reach them anymore. The fact is, though, a lot of this is symbolic, too. What we look at is we see that there are figures like Hafez Saeed, who represents this jihadi group, Jamaat-ud-Dawah, that these people have had opportunities here to spread a brand of anti-American and anti-Indian propaganda, and also were involved in the planning of operations against India. We want to see both the Haqqanis and the Taliban and these jihadi groups, we want to see them shut down. Now, that's a tall order for Pakistan. These groups, particularly the jihadi groups, are well integrated into Pakistan society here. Their narrative here about the United States and most of these conspiracy theories that are out there about the United States really were one time marginal. In a marginal narrative, now they've become pretty much the narrative of most Pakistanis who buy into some of the most ridiculous conspiracy theories, but this is what we're up against here. No Pakistanis, whether it's the military or the civilians, is going to take at this point the necessary political risks to deal with this. So their argument is, look, we know this is against our interests, but we've got to do it slowly. Our concern has been, and others too, has been, yes, but you're not really showing the determination that you've got to show in order to succeed.
I wanted to ask you about one of the issues that the White House has raised in the last day or day and a half for this cutoff in aid, and that is what the Trump administration is calling a lack of religious freedom in Pakistan. And in fact, yesterday, the State Department put Pakistan on its religious freedom watch list, citing its blasphemy law. Now, the Pakistani constitution guarantees freedom of religion, not just for different religions, but for different sects within Islam. I know when I lived in Pakistan, I met Christians and Shia Muslims and Sunni Muslims and Baha'is, etc. Is this a legitimate problem? Is there really a lack of religious freedom in Pakistan?
Well, look, you're right as far as the protections that these groups will have in the law. But the blasphemy law itself overrides this in many ways. It makes anyone from these groups, or any Muslim for that matter, highly vulnerable to accusations here of committing blasphemy. What we're really seeing is a response here, not only to the fact that the blasphemy law, in effect, has been strengthened by recent demonstrations that took place in and around several cities, but particularly around Islamabad, in which when the demonstrators left, they came away with a strengthening, in an agreement with the government, a strengthening of the blasphemy laws. And as I say, these laws have been used in the most egregious ways. They have caught innocent individuals. They've been used as a way of one party seeking attack another, and of course the death penalty is out there. Now, one more thing, and that is that there have been attacks on minority groups throughout the country, but particularly against Shia groups, and especially against a group of Hazaras who are both who are Shia and whose origins are Afghan. And they have been really the targets of so much of this sectarian warfare that's been going on.
And especially on holy days and in their mosques when there are the most number of people gathered.
Right, and this is happening in Afghanistan now as well, which it never had before. There's a longer tradition here of sectarian conflict in Pakistan. And it, together with what has happened with the blasphemy law and the fact that that as much as everybody, I think, right-thinking people recognize how it's been misused, the government really does not have the authority here. This is a weak government, by and large, to be able to stand up to those who would challenge any effort here to weaken the law, to create greater protection for Pakistanis, particularly in the minority, but not only the minority community. Any Pakistanis are liable to be charged under the blasphemy law.
We're speaking with Marvin Weinbaum. Marvin, we have 90 seconds left. What about Pakistan, China, historically geostrategic allies? Does this push Pakistan more in the direction of the People's Republic of China?
Well, it has come closer to China now than it ever had before, because China, although it's always been viewed as a all-weather friend, has promised and is beginning to deliver on $57 billion worth of investment in Pakistan. This is a large sum, but however large it is, it has psychologically affected the Pakistanis, who now feel a great deal more independence of the United States. They think that, we're not going to be isolated. So you want to alienate us? Fine, go ahead and do that. We're tired. You hear this from the foreign minister and others saying, "Well, we've been trying to please you for too long, so let's forget about the whole thing." We're hearing that kind of thinking, and they're much more confident in taking that position now because they feel that they've got China behind them.
Very interesting. Of course, the Belt and Road Initiative, John, it's a long-term game changer in Pakistan, for the region, for Eurasia. Anyway, we've exhausted our time here. We haven't exhausted the subject. We've been joined from Washington by Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar in residence for the Middle East Institute Center for Pakistan Studies. After a short break, we'll be back with the top news stories of the day. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.